Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IA's YouTube channel, IA London. But we've taken the audio and we've turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
Welcome to a very special edition of Parallax Views, part of the IEA's YouTube cultural affairs output. My name is Mark Glendenning, and today I'm going to be talking to an old friend of mine, Brian Denny. He's a journalist who specialises in trade union and cultural affairs. In addition to being a folk musician, he's a prolific producer of music. This is his CD about the River Thames, Working River, Songs and Music of the Thames, critically acclaimed by the Times of London, no less. Brian is not going to be a typical IEA interviewee in that he's actually going to be singing us some of his songs, not something I imagine Friedrich von Hayek would have done. And he's going to be doing this as part of a wider discussion we're going to be having about the politics and history of folk music, and in particular the importance folk music has had for the British left traditionally, though, as we will discover, some on the more contemporary wokey end of the left-wing movement are less than keen on it, naturally. Brian has also written this excellent pamphlet, Folk and the English Radical Tradition, which is part of the Letters on Liberty series that the Academy of Ideas have published. And lastly, he'll be talking to us about a very fascinating literary and political figure, Edgar Rickword, which is a name I'm glad I don't have to say after Brian and I have gone off for our liquid lunch after this. So Brian, before you sing your first song, I think you should tell the boys and girls at home how our bromance actually started, because we were brought together by a rather interesting cartoon character. I know this sounds all rather surreal, but I'm going to hand over to you now to
Captain Euro. There he is. There he is, and he still exists on the podosphere, and he goes on in a childlike manner talking about EU foreign policy. But yeah, it was an attempt to create a cultural wing of the European Union, which after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of people on the left decided that the new messiah, the saviour, was going to be the European Union, rather than anything domestic, either in Britain or anywhere else in Europe. And so I was in a bit of a minority. We was in the campaign against Eurofederalism. We used to produce The Democrat.
Marvellous publication, yeah. I remember it well.
And we used to spoof the Captain Euro. One of the cartoons of Captain Euro at the time was the Aryan assistant, the female assistant, shouts to Captain Euro, "Look, Captain, people who doubt Belgium." It's a very sinister kind of...
You're not allowed to doubt Belgium.
And Captain Euro's response is, "Quick, to the Euro called," which I assume means they can garrote people that doubt the European Union. So in the mid-90s, anyway, about 25 years ago, the press release went out, and I was working in the Morning Star as a cub reporter, and one of the more Europhile members of the staff said laughingly, "Oh, you'd want to cover this." And I actually took it quite seriously, because I thought it was a serious attempt to create a cultural wing.
And to brainwash children.
That was the
explicit aim of it.
Because the interesting thing about corporate culture, it's very sterile. And so they were trying to attempt to engage children with other cartoons as well, like the ice cream, raspberry ice cream wars, which involved two countries one develops raspberry ice cream and the other one develops cornets, like you would. And there was no, there's no way you could have free trade unless the European Commission was overseeing it and making it all happen. So we went along, and I was at the front, and I think you was at the back, and I was like on my own. I think you had a cohort of dedicated campaigners, and I just at the end, I just put my hand up and went Q&As, and I said, "Well, why have you got these curious Captain Euro and the with a German Shepherd, of course."
Yes, that was very similar.
And these Aryan assistants with the blonde hair. And they're fighting these Judeo-Arabic looking criminals who are trying to steal our culture.
Dr. Divider. Goes around Europe stealing works of art from Europe's
and
art
threatening
galleries.
To set off nuclear weapons like you do.
And all Eurosceptics tend to do that.
And they were very miffed by that, and I think you was at the back talking about indoctrination and all that. But anyway, we found it was a success. I think our mission was accomplished because they shut the press conference down rather rapidly because they didn't expect such a
this level visceral, of ridicule,
visceral response and hilarity. And I think we went off and had lunch somewhere, and then we decided that we had more in common than that divided us, like Dr. Divider.
I see what you did there. That's very good. And you, just before you sing the song, you actually created your own political party, left-wing political party, to contest two sets of European elections.
Yeah, Bob Crowe. 2008, I was on the tube, and I said to Bob, we were going to work, and I said, the Labour Party can't get elected because of the... I don't know if you remember at the time, there's a lot of hoo-ha about corruption in Parliament, shock, horror. And I think all the political parties were in disarray. And so I said, now's the time we should set up a left-wing Eurosceptic party, because the whole idea was the UKIP was like, it's painted as anyone that didn't support the euro and the intense, you know, the ever closer union was somehow deranged and mental. And on the far right of the political
mad
spectrum.
Or bad, yeah.
Mad or bad. And so Bob loved that idea because he thought it was so mischievous. And, in 10 weeks, we launched a campaign, and I think you helped out in some constituency. We set up, we put up 105 candidates across the country, and we gained about 170,000 votes, which is about 1 in 10 voted no to EU, which is what we set out to do, really. Yeah. Rather than and the other thing was we said we wouldn't take our seats, which was seen as.
I'm sure you would have done if you'd been elected.
If I'd been elected, I would have taken
it straight away. Brussels,
I'd have rushed
a lot of muscles to be consumed.
I would have taken the money and run. But the point is, UKIP were very upset because obviously no to EU was further up the paper than UKIP, because it was folded. So they were going to take us to court for nicking their votes. And so that was that. So, and I think what it did alert rank and file people to the idea that there was a left-wing, democratic, beyond the left actually, democratic arguments that against our membership of the European Union, which was a massive breakthrough, really, when you consider there was this, the media attention and the kind of official trade union TUC was that everyone was fanatically in support of the euro. And actually, that wasn't true. And the other thing we did, we made a CD, of course, a CD of music.
Yes, I remember this one.
Eurosceptic music. Yeah. And I've given you some copies. Historical document, actually.
Fantastic. I mean, you've got Tony Benn at the top.
Yes, he
that's right.
Did a gig with Mr. Roy Bailey about the democratic history of a tradition of democracy, the radical tradition in Britain. So, yeah. And that all links with that.
So you're going to sing us a song now?
Okay, I could do that. This is the song off that album. It's about Brexit, but it's not really. It's a metaphor, Brexit, about how relationships come to an end, and you really have to just sort of, you know, suck it up.
We've all been there.
We've all been there. And this is the relationship between Britain and the European Union. It's called Do This, and you don't have to sing along.
I think that'll be better if I do. Thank you.
we'd always be friends. But every sea comes to an end, and you keep asking me for more. Now I think we've reached that shore. I can't do this anymore. I'm tired of my head being on this floor. Not once, not twice, not even four. I just can't do this anymore. We both sailed turbulent seas. We both got the same disease. And how this will end, I'm not sure. But it's time that I took that cure. I can't do this anymore. My bones are tired and sore. And I felt like this before. And I just can't do this anymore. With time we both got off our knees. Learn, thank you and please. Learn what is right and what is wrong. Oh, it's time that we learn a different song. 'Cause I can't do this anymore. The who, the why and what for. I just stopped keeping score. 'Cause I just can't do this. And you can't do this, and we just can't do this anymore.
Brilliant, thank you.
That's
feeling
Brexit,
very emotional, but I also think there's a subtone here. But,
yeah, that's
but
it.
We won't go there.
You got it. it could be us.
So, as they would say, or used to say on The X Factor, could you tell us a little bit about your journey? How did you become interested in folk music? I mean, is it connected in a way to your left-wing politics, or is it something completely independent of that?
When I was a young child, my yeah, my family didn't have many records. We had a Yehudi Menuhin album, some mad Irish mini disc, and then we had this Woody Guthrie mini disc with four songs on it, and I just thought that was pop music. I didn't really, you know, it was very sort of insular family, apart from T-Rex. This is before T-Rex, of course, and I used to listen to it all the time, and I thought that was great, but it was really rough Woody Guthrie. But then I realised later on that actually we have our own traditions, we have our own traditions to look into, and that have been largely forgotten, and the folk explosion had kind of died away, and in the 80s became less culturally to the fore. But to me, it spoke to me, it explained who I was, where I come from, and the idea that indigenous culture is important in every country, and every country has it. And everyone talks about Irish folk music as well, as if the English don't have any. And the more I talked to people, the more I said, well, there's no such thing as English folk. And I mean, it was extraordinary. And then I started looking into it. And, of course, there is. There's loads of it. And I just got drawn to it because it's a part of who I am. And I'm lucky to have lived on the coast, and we had a folk club. And all these old fellas were singing these great sea shanties and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we've given more folk to the world than you think. I mean, in Finland, they sing English folk shanties. You know, and as well as in Breton in France. So, yeah, so I think, and it's, I think it's very important to have your own culture. And I think a part of the onslaught of globalisation is to remove indigenous cultures, you know, music, and to even belittle the idea of the nation state. And I think the attacks on the concept of the nation state through the European Union and through, you know, neoliberal globalisation is a part of that, to negate national cultures. And it's, so we're feeling it everywhere, but it's particularly true in England, I think, because people are uncomfortable increasingly with being English. And so I think it's really important to remember that and to sort of look into, because there is another history of England which Edgar Rickword talks about with studies, which is the history of Robin Hood, the Peasants' Revolt, the English Civil War, and these were, and the Chartists were all accompanied by music and song, and that that is the basis of our democracy. It wasn't given to us by a landowner or some rich capitalist. It was built over 1,200 years of, you know, struggle, really. And I think that's been forgotten, because in the sort of post-rationalist era, democracy and rationalism and the Enlightenment is under attack. And I think in the same way, indigenous forms of music are under attack, in that they're dismissed as backward-looking, reactionary, and somehow problematic, and a barrier to creating a world government and world culture, which I think is, you know, would lead us to Captain Euro. I mean, who wants that?
Well, quite exactly. And if, I think it's worth pointing out, your brother Mick is also a folk musician.
Yeah, yeah. My brother is. Yeah,
yeah.
I taught
him. Did you lead him into it, or was it the other way round? Well, both simultaneously.
Well, I don't want to upset the boy. You know.
No. Okay. Well, modesty. We
had our own paths.
Yes. Okay.
And we've come together in, right, in unity.
Now, folk music in the popular imagination for a lot of people outside of it sort of evokes images of, you know, Cecil Sharp in Tweedy plus fours. Women with lank, greying hair, frumpy dresses and CND symbols. It has that kind of, Morris dancing, it has that kind of imagery. But there is a more edgy, as you've just alluded to, but perhaps you'll expand on this, a more edgy, radical tradition of song.
It's very much alive, and I love Morris dancing. I mean, it's a real shame that we don't do it more, because it is very edgy. Morris dancing, I mean, the history...
Oh, is it? I mean, tell me.
Well, the history of Morris dancing is that it was... there's a reason they used to black up as well, and it wasn't altogether because they're all racist, but it was a form of rebellion in the villages. And they used to get together, and they used to disguise themselves to sing and dance and create mayhem without the landowners and the farmers knowing who they were.
So
it was a fundamental part of rural English... particularly English culture. And like all dancing, it has a radical edge. I mean, if you look at the dancing in Latin America, the slave dancers, that was all forms of learning how to use your body to defend yourself. And the only way they could do it was by pretending it was a dance. And so dance and a song has always been a form of resistance, in fact, because... and. All the songs were written about themselves. It wasn't written about anyone else. So they were sort of serfdom was really so oppressive. I mean, in the 8th century, there was a priest who wrote about serfdom. It was called Serf Labour is Irksome. And it was a poem about that. And so it was their own existence. And no one else could do it. Only they could do it. Because only they existed in... feudalism, and that's where their own culture came from, a resistance to the miserable lives they were living. And I think that carried on through the Industrial Revolution and through into the 20th century in different ways. And people still writing about their own existence and their own experiences, and that is, for me, is a form of resistance. However mellow it may seem, it's still conveying a message of we are people, we have dignity, and we have our own rights to defend and celebrate, you know.
And I think going back to the EU question, people with very different political backgrounds like you and me were coming together, but what I felt at that time was that this was a great democratic struggle, which was bringing together different component parts of the British radical tradition, which I think initially was united by an opposition to feudalism, was a desire to see the extension of democratic rights. And so I think there is a common sort of stem or root to the British radical tradition, which perhaps during the 19th century with the development of industry and the Industrial Revolution, then it split into different factions connected to labour and capital. But there's a fundamental democratic point of origin, even if people diverge on economics. And I think maybe what we're seeing now, as we saw with Brexit, is a cultural realignment again, whereby people who believe in political liberty and freedom of speech are sort of converging again, even though they may have differences on very specific issues like how society should be organised economically, you know, the health service and what have you. But because liberal democracy is now, again, I think, profoundly under attack from this kind of postmodernist new leftism, I think we're seeing people with very divergent views and histories now coming together. And we're seeing it with some, for example, some of the feminist movement who are under attack because of the transgender, their position on transgenderism. So people of left-wing feminists are coming together with centre-right libertarians
Free speech. I think that's true, Mark, but I think it was also always there in a sense of, you know, I think David Hannon said you can tell a man by what side they were on the Battle of Marston Moor or whatever, you know, in terms of the English Civil War.
We would have been on the same side.
Yeah. Exactly.
We'd have been with the levellers and the diggers.
And I think at the time, when we started this whole crusade for democracy against the tyranny of the European Union, we understood that. I mean, it was quite clear that it was like, you know, and this goes back to the Second World War, when it was quite clear that the left supported the idea of Churchill, even though he was a Tory, being the leader, fighting against fascism. So in the early 20th century, you had these examples of that. And in the 19th century, the Corn Laws was a...
Another great example.
And
it radical
was,
unity.
Yeah, radical unity. But, of course, it was the Tories that got rid of the Corn Laws. And it, ultimately, the great reform acts of the 1860s, it was the Tory party, after the Chartists had campaigned for a half a century to expand the franchise of working men, it was the Tory party that actually brought in the 1860s. So there you have another alliance when the Tory party didn't have to do that. But they massively expanded the franchise, extraordinarily, actually. So,
And
that's a forgotten concept. And so all throughout the history, the left and the right have worked together on the Corn Laws, on the franchise, against the external threat of fascism. And so I don't think it's that odd. Really,
yeah.
And actually, and what unites the left and right is the Enlightenment. It is the idea of rational ideas, and this is what the problem that the Soviet Union created was that the unerring belief in everything the Soviet Union did actually disrupted the rational left in a sense of some of the more eccentric experiments of the 50s in the Soviet Union were accepted here. As scientific, when it obviously wasn't. It was nonsense, you know, Lysenko and all that stuff.
Yeah.
There. So, and I think that interrupted the alliance of rationalism and the Enlightenment. And I think that was an interruption of that and confused people on the left. But ultimately, Marl Mann was on the left in Basildon, and he worked with Tories all the time. I mean, when you think about it, even in Northern Ireland, the Sinn Féin grassroots works with unionists on issues. So it's not unusual for the left and right to work together. It's only become unusual because the new intolerance of that you cannot have different views.
Yeah,
and I think that's the difference. So what I'm talking about is that the alliance of the left and right is not unusual, and it goes back a thousand years in the sense that some of the rebellions, Robert Kett's rebellion in Norfolk. Robert Kett was a landowner, but he led the rebellion. The peasants' revolt of 1381 was led by merchants. They was led by the middle class. It wasn't peasants. I mean, it's a misnomer that it was a peasant.
Oh, really?
It was a great rebellion.
Yeah.
Against the idea of a maximum wage in feudal Britain after the plague, which got rid of half of the population. The government said, right, there must be a maximum wage. Not minimum wage. You can't pay people more 10p a week. And the merchants saying, well, we can't operate like this. And so there's a mass rebellion against the king and the feudal lords who wanted to keep wages very low.
Right.
So that's 700, 800 years ago. So it's not unusual for people who have different economic views. I mean, ultimately, it comes down to the nation state. It's where you believe.
And democracy, I suppose that's right. I mean, you can have all the differences in the world on all kinds of issues, but if you can't actually argue for what you want and vote for what you want within a democratic forum
and ultimately
and process, then it doesn't matter what your differences of opinion are.
The European Commission decides, but the highest form of democracy can only exist within the nation state. That seems to be the case to me, and I believe that. And if you live in a nation state without sovereignty and self-determination, then you have no recourse to change the future, you know.
Yeah.
And it's also the only place where legitimate government can operate, and with the acquiescence of people who don't agree with them.
Otherwise, you've got imperialism, and the struggle against imperialism was again something that brought together people from the left and the liberal right in the 19th century. The term Little Englander is actually levelled at liberals who were against imperialism.
I can make a Marxist out of you yet.
So, moving on. Sounded a bit like Ronnie Corbett then. Nobody under 60 would know who he was, so we'll move on. In your pamphlet, Folk and the English Radical Tradition, there's a great quote from the historian E.P. Thompson. Probably from, 70 years ago, something like that. And it goes, it is exactly this emphasis upon national cultural experience which a contemporary generation of Marxist intellectuals in England, but not in Scotland and Wales, most distrust and deride in their forerunners. So this rejection of English culture and popular culture is not entirely something new. I mean, I think it's got a lot worse, but it's interesting that E.P. Thompson...
Well, I use that...
And why, as a man of the left, why do you think that is? What is at the genesis of this disdain for English folk music, English literature?
When E.P. Thompson was writing, he was writing about Edgar Rickword, of course, which is what this pamphlet's about. And Edgar Rickword is the key, I think, to understanding... Edgar Rickword is probably the most influential 20th century writer and critical essayist that you've never heard of. He was from Essex, from Colchester. He was a self-taught poet and critical analyst who, in the First World War, taught himself French in the trenches. And he discovered Baudelaire and Arthur Rimbaud. And he came back, and he became a trench poet after reading Sassoon and all that. But he came back to England really angry because the English kind of idiom was still missing because it was very much steeped in the imperialist ideas. And after the war, that was still the case. So E.P. Thompson was writing about Edgar Rickword, who attempted to change that. Now, throughout the 20s, he was the editor of a calendar of modern letters, went up against T.S. Eliot, who became a fascist with
Ezra Pound.
Ezra Pound.
True.
And he was very dismissive of the Communist Party, of course, but which was also dismissive of English culture, Dickens and all this. It was also year zero, you know, it was all going to be from the Soviet Union. And it was only with the threat of fascism Edgar Rickword said, look, now is the time. Now is the time to rediscover English radicalism. If you're going to, because you're not going to get anywhere unless you inspire the English to do something. Because the left in England has never flourished without the English, because obviously the numbers count. And he wrote a book called A Handbook for Freedom with Jack Lindsay, which looked at the whole history of the working class movements throughout 12 centuries. And it transformed everything. And it created the cultural popular front of the 1930s that we all remember about pageants of Englishness and, you know, Trafalgar Square, the Communist Party put on a whole thing about the England arise and all this, and communism is English. That was one of their phrases. So anyway, this went on all through the Second World War, and E.P. Thompson had a copy of that book, Handbook for Freedom, throughout the war. And he came back, and the famous history group of E.P. Thompson, Christopher Hill, Raphael Samuel, all the historians got down and started studying this stuff, right? And that changed everything, because they become dissidents, in a sense, because they were looking at English history. Christopher Hill, particularly on the English Civil War, and not looking at the developments in the Soviet Union, because they thought that wasn't as important as what was going on here, because you have to create change here, yeah, not over there, you know, sort of thing. And Edgar Rickword was made an editor of this magazine called Our Time, which was using all these ideas and publishing broadly liberal thinkers about English thought, about the radical tradition. And in 1947, there's this extraordinary meeting in which Emil Burns, which is the cultural commissariat of the CPGB, brought in Rickword. And he used these young members, and one of them was E.P. Thompson, to humiliate him and said he was a renegade, a degenerate, and all this, because they decided, because the Cold War was coming, it was time just to defend the Soviet Union. And all this English stuff...
Oh, I see, right.
All this English stuff was getting in the way of defence of the Soviet Union. And he just sat there through the whole meeting, and he didn't say a word. And it's great. I mean, it must have been an extraordinary moment. And E.P. Thompson writes about it, and that's where that quote comes from. And he was standing there, and he said that was the moment that the 10 years of extraordinary flowering of Popular Front ideas about democracy and about how Britain would look in a different way outside of imperialism and depression and all the rest of it came to an end. That meeting, it came to an end for him. And it's extraordinary. Anyway, Edgar Rickword gets up and he walks out and he gets on a train and he opens a bookshop in Deal. And he never held it against anyone, but that was it. It was it for him. And he just kept publishing pamphlets and books about the Regency period, about extraordinary brave democracy campaigners that no one's ever heard of. But it was... that moment was gone, so he was publishing all his stuff. Mm. It was one fella called William Hone who got done for blasphemy about four times during the early 1800s, and he defended himself and won. But because that period had gone and it was all about the Cold War and, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States, all that was just forgotten. And so I think it's now emblematic of something that's really important that's still there.
And which needs to be revived now in the cause of free political discourse and real cultural diversity, whereby people can act the part of people.
And it's what's important is free speech, of course.
Yeah,
he was denied his free speech to what he thought by the party, which is a disgrace, absolute disgrace. I mean, it was all right, you know, the week before, and now he was denied that. And I think free speech and democracy are really important, and I think some people are being vilified. And, you know, I've lost some friends over Brexit.
I bet you have.
I lost them before Brexit.
So you're going to sing us a song about Edgar? What song are you going to do?
This is a song, this song is 400 years old. It was in the Handbook of Freedom. And it's it was first written down in 1620, which is a long time ago. It's before the English Civil War.
Yes.
But it's very lucid. It's got about 48 verses, and I'm not going to do that. All right, I'll do all 48 verses, mate. And it's called, it's about the tyranny of feudalism, about the poor man pays for all. But what struck me in 2008, when the banks all collapsed, there was trillions and trillions of pounds were put into the banks. And it never came out again. And someone's had to pay for it, haven't they? And it's usually the taxpayer.
Well, right. Well, yeah. I mean, again, this is a theme where maybe some from the left and some from the centre-right will converge, because a lot of people on the centre-right were against the crony capitalism.
I think Dominic Frisby calls it crony capitalism, but the point is, it's the same, but the poor man is still paying for all, in my terms, and in how I see it. But this was published in the 1940s, and as far as I know, and I'm working on an album of these songs, of radical songs, that we can get out next year, and I want to call the album The Poor Man Pays For All, because I think it's just a fantastic song. And what it is, it's a dream state poem. It's not, we put it to music. In the 1600s, when people wrote poetry, usually in dream states, you know, the world turned upside down and that sort of thing. And so this is one called The Poor Man Pays For All. I was musing all alone upon my resting bed. Oh, many a cogitation did come into my head. Oh, waking from my sleep, a dream I did recall. Methought I saw before mine eyes how the poor man pays for all. And the poor man pays for all, me boys, the poor man pays for all. Thought I saw before my eyes how the poor man pays for all. We thought I saw how wealthy men did grind the poor man's faces, and greedily did prey on them, not pitying their cases. Well, they make them toil and labour sore for wages far too small, while the rich man in the taverns roar, the poor man pays for all. The poor man pays for all, me boys, the poor man pays for all. While the rich man in the taverns roar, the poor man pays for all. Methought I saw a usurer walk in his Foxford gown. His wealth and eminence controlled most men in town. His wealth he by extortion got and rose while others fall. Had put his hands at earning nuts, and the poor man pays for all. And the poor man pays for all, me boys, the poor man pays for all. And he had put his hands at earning nuts, and the poor man pays for all. Methought I saw a lawyer base one to the other say, we have in hand this poor man's case for 12 months and a day. Yet we'll not be contented to let the matter fall. So bear thou with me and I'll bear with thee, and the poor man will pay for all. The poor man pays for all, me boys, the poor man pays for all. Bear thou with me and I'll bear with thee, and the poor man will pay for all. Even as the mighty fish is still, does feed upon the less. So the rich man might have his will, but on the poor man cess. It's a proverb old and true that the weakest goes to the wall. And the rich man drinks till the sky is blue, and the poor man pays for all. And the poor man pays for all, me boys, the poor man pays for all. While the rich man drinks till the sky is blue, and the poor man pays for all.
Brilliant.
You like that?
Thank you. I really like that. I haven't heard it before.
That was only there's 48 verses of it.
I know. I was a bit disappointed you didn't do that a lot.
Yeah,
but that is
it's a saga.
A great, great song. It's been fascinating talking to you, as ever, but it's wonderful, I think, that we've managed to capture the gems of your thoughts and your incredible historical insights on film. So I'm very, very grateful to you for coming in. And I know you have a lot of merchandise to sell.
not
to sell in this case. So I'm just going to remind you of the Letters on Liberty series produced by the Academy of Ideas, Folk and the English Radical Tradition, that Brian has written, which is a wonderful document. And then, of course, Working River, Songs and Music of the Thames, which you have curated, and which includes that song.
No, it doesn't. Oh, I've made a terrible faux pas.
There's another song about a female smuggler.
That's the Lizzie Little,
yeah.
Yes, which is a great song, which I have heard. So, Brian, it just leaves me to thank you on behalf of the IEA. Probably one of the most original meetings, or certainly YouTube films, this august institution has been party to. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I got a lot out of it. Very funny. And if you want to buy the CD, of course, you go to gftu.org.uk. 21 songs all about the River Thames that you've probably never heard, and they're great. Barges, yeah. Oh, and the Ennore Mutiny, of course. One of the biggest mutinies of the English Navy took place on the Thames.
Quickly tell us about that.
Well, the Ennore Mutiny...
Can't just let that hang.
1798, the Ennore Mutiny, they mutinied. There hadn't been a pay rise in the English Navy for 150 years. And so they mutinied. And it was the first time the red flag was ever raised, because it means, you know, to be under. And in the end, obviously, the leader of the mutiny, there's a song about him called Richard Parker, was hung from the yardarm. But there was massive increases in conditions. And so in a way, it succeeded. So there's two songs in honour of that. One written in 1798 and one written last year. So these songs, these traditions are still being talked and written about, because ultimately in folk music is you delve into your own history, because no one else is going to do it for you.
Great. And on that note,
thanks.
Thank you again. Thank you.